Good afternoon. Welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Sai Yuan, a member of Club's International Forum, and your chair for today. We welcome our audience here and on the air, and invite everyone to visit us on the internet at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now, it's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker for today. As we just had a chance to breathe a sigh of relief after the end of the Cold War, 9/11 hit us like a ton of bricks. Obviously, the focus of our national security had to be shifted to an entirely different focus. So what do we do now? There's no one better qualified to address this question than our speaker, Mr. Melvin Goodman. Mr. Goodman was a Soviet analyst at the CIA and Department of State for 24 years and professor of international relations at the National War College. He was with the U.S. Army in Athens, Greece, and was intelligence advisor for the SALT delegation from 1971 to 1972. Currently, Mr. Goodman is a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy in Washington, D.C., and adjunct professor of government at the Johns Hopkins University. He is the author of many books and publications, including this latest called National Insecurity Cost of American Militarism, which he will autograph for you after this session. Now, please join me in welcoming Mr. Goodman.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you for that introduction, and thank you for the invitation to come out here to discuss the book. Let me say a few things about why I wrote the book in the first place. Several years ago, Bob Gates, the Secretary of Defense, made it known before he announced he was going to leave the administration that he was going to go back to the state of Washington. Bob is someone I have followed closely over the years. I testified against him in 1991 when he was nominated to be the CIA director. And as an Obama supporter, of course, I was shocked to find out he was going to be kept on as Obama's Secretary of Defense. But what he told people I found interesting, and it was the major reason for why I wanted to write this book. And what he said was, we are moving toward a smaller military that will do fewer things and be able to go fewer places, which he thought was a terrible thing. And he added, and I don't want to be a part of that kind of a system that's going to retrench. Now, my feeling has always been that we need a smaller military that will do fewer things and go to fewer places. So that is the kind of book that I wanted to write. I thought that I should do it, even though others have really mined a lot of this. I'm sure a lot of you are familiar with the works of Andy Bacevich, for example, who wrote things such as The American Empire. And 10 years before that, John Newhouse, one of my favorite New Yorker writers, wrote Imperial America. And there other books have dealt with this. But I have, I think, an unusual background in a sense in that I spent 42 years in the government, the Army, the State Department, Defense Department, the CIA. I had security clearances for that entire length of time. And I was convinced that the kind of contrarian spirit that you need as an intelligence officer should be taken to this field of the defense budget and the military. We're always told that Social Security is the third rail of American politics. And I guess it is, but another third rail of American politics and American policy is the defense budget. And unfortunately, if you look at what you read in the so-called mainstream press, including the best of it, the New York Times, 85 to 90% of what we read in the paper and what we read in our magazines comes from official sources. We're basically getting what people in very important positions want us to read. It is very difficult for a contrarian to get into the mainstream press. And I know that from personal experience. So in some ways, the easiest thing to do is, if you have something to say, is just try to draft a manuscript and see what happens. Now, the starting point for me has to be Eisenhower. And everyone is familiar, of course, with the farewell address from 1961, the warning about the military-industrial complex. I was a student at Johns Hopkins in 1961, and the president of Johns Hopkins happened to be his brother, Milton. And Milton used to secretly go back and forth. We knew it as students because he met with students from time to time, but the press never knew it. He was very influential in the Eisenhower administration. And he knew, for example, and told us that when Eisenhower got the draft about the military-industrial complex, he added congressional. And it's there in his own hand in the draft of the speech. But when he gave the speech, he dropped congressional. And Milton asked his brother, why did you do that? And he said, well, it was enough to take on military and industry. I couldn't take on the Congress, too. Even though it was the Congress that was the great source of frustration for him 50 years ago in terms of trying to talk sense into people about the size of the military establishment, which is now totally out of control. Even though I have a few things to say about Obama's second term, because having been very disappointed by the first term, I'm somewhat optimistic that he has learned some lessons. Being as smart as he is, and reasonable as he is, and disappointed with the military because of what happened in Afghanistan and what he was sold in terms of the surge, I expect some different things to happen, but I'll get to that in a minute. The other things that Eisenhower did that were important in this frame would be the Cross of Iron speech that he gave in his first term, in which he said, when we are spending these huge sums of money for the military, we're not only spending our wealth, and this is a quote, we're spending the sweat of our laborers, the genius of our scientists, and the hopes of our children. And he talked about, if you didn't build a destroyer, how many schools and bridges and power plants you could build, or if you didn't build a strategic bomber, what you could do with that kind of money. And he stopped a lot of things. He didn't buy the Gaither Report. He didn't buy all of the talk about the missile gap that John Kennedy unfortunately did buy into, even when he was told that the information he was giving in the campaign of 1960 was false. Eisenhower also talked about the dangers of permanent war, something that we should be familiar with because we've been in permanent war for the past decade. And he talked about civil liberties, which doesn't get a lot of attention, but should. And again, if you think of the last 10 years and you look at the first 10 amendments of the Constitution, you know, what have we done about the Fourth Amendment, illegal searches and seizures? Think of the warrantless eavesdropping from the National Security Agency. There was the killing without due process of al-Awlaki, and some people had no problem with that. Well, what about the killing of his teenage son 2 weeks later, also an American citizen? Fifth Amendment talks about due process. The Sixth Amendment talks about speedy trial. Well, if you're Bradley Manning, and I'm not carrying any brief for Manning. I mean, if we want to discuss WikiLeaks, we can. But the fact of the matter is we're approaching 3 years since Manning has been in jail, and the trial is supposed to start in June, and who knows if it really will. So that amendment certainly comes into play. And then the other night, a couple nights ago, I saw Zero Dark Thirty, which is, to me, started the wrong kind of debate. The debate shouldn't be whether torture works or not. The debate should be whether we should be engaged in torture. Now, the movie muddies the message, unfortunately, in terms of whether it works, even though it gives a very implicit but indirect connection. The fact of the matter is we learned nothing from the torture and the use of waterboarding that had any important relationship to the killing of Osama bin Laden. And the one person from the CIA who's a retired operations officer, who's been allowed to run around and talk about the importance of torture, is Jose Rodriguez, who was the one who destroyed the torture tapes, which I am told were sadistic in nature, as you can imagine. Now, he claims that he destroyed them because it would have compromised the identity of CIA agents. The CIA people who were involved in the torture and abuse and the waterboarding were masked. So that's nonsense. So this is a very dangerous activity for the CIA to get into, because basically if Jose Rodriguez can write pieces for the Outlook section of the Washington Post and other places, he's getting these pieces cleared as a former CIA official. So I think the civil liberties aspect is important. And finally, Eisenhower said something informally that was not in any of his writings. He was sitting around maybe weeks before he left the White House in December of 1960 with his close advisors, and he said, "God help the United States when the people who sit in this chair that I'm sitting in the Oval Office, do not understand the military the way I do." And he held off the military, and he held off the right wing, and he held off the Congress in a lot of military efforts. Now, I get into it in the book. I won't get into it tonight. There was a terrible area that he didn't hold off the right wing and the conservatives, and that was his use of covert action. And this cannot be separated from Eisenhower's overall record, because when you look at the CIA activities, illegal activities, I would argue, in covert action, they started in the Eisenhower administration. The coup in Iran in 1953, the coup in Guatemala, the Bay of Pigs plan grew up under the Eisenhower administration. He was smart enough not to do it. Kennedy was dumb enough and naive enough and inexperienced enough to try it. Indonesia, I mean, all of this covert action that we think about really had its genesis in the two Eisenhower terms. Now, the point about presidents who know nothing about the military is important. My book turns on, in terms of the starting point, would be the strategic opportunity this country had in 1989 to 1991 to do things differently that we didn't do, which was abetted by having four presidents who either knew nothing about the military, Clinton, Obama, the younger Bush, or a president who served in the military but didn't want to deal with the military, and that was George Herbert Walker Bush. So when you look at the contributions these four individuals made, it's no surprise that we're in the terrible situation that we're in now that has to be corrected. Now, it's interesting when you look at the George Herbert Walker Bush administration. He had three important people at the Defense Department, his Secretary of Defense, Dick Cheney. Dick Cheney's two key aides at that time were Scooter Libby and Paul Wolfowitz. This is the key triumvirate in the Iraq War, 2002-2003, in terms of the planning that took place for that war that was based on just a tailored pattern of total deception and outright lies and misconception. They, in the earlier Bush administration, they put together a secret paper for defense planning guidance that talked about unilateralism. So instead of taking advantage of the strategic opportunity that turned on the collapse of the Berlin Wall in 1989, the collapse of the Warsaw Pact in 1990, the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991, all of the things we didn't expect to see in our lifetime unless there was violence. I don't think we ever expected. I certainly didn't expect to see this while I was involved in government affairs or involved in the intelligence community. I mean, a couple of us wrote about the problems of the Soviet Union. No one expected it to collapse like a house of cards. But it's, someone said the Soviet Union was a house of cards. How else could it collapse? But this opportunity was totally not taken by the Bush administration. You had things like the invasion of Panama to arrest Noriega. Noriega had been on the CIA payroll for most of the time I was at the CIA, for nearly two decades. That's a hell of a precedent to set in terms of the use of the military. There was no vision in the Bush administration. He had a very conservative national security advisor who a lot of people portray as a moderate. General Scowcroft, I don't think, is a moderate. He's extremely conservative, but speaks like a moderate, and I think gets a very favorable press. But no one had any real ideas about how to deal with this great strategic opportunity. Fortunately, we had two senators, Nunn, the Democrat from Georgia, and Lugar, the Republican from Indiana, who was just defeated in a primary, which is a real loss in terms of trying to create bipartisan foreign policy in Washington. And their cooperative threat reduction was probably one of the most important congressional initiatives we have ever seen. The idea that you could take that kind of money from the defense budget, which didn't make the military very happy, and apply it to demilitarizing the strategic arsenal of the former Soviet Union was extremely important. We go from Bush to Clinton. Clinton really didn't want to deal with foreign policy. Like so many presidents, they felt they were elected to do domestic things. Clinton had no background in foreign policy, no real interest in foreign policies. People say he went to Georgetown, the Foreign Service School. Well, that's really not good enough as far as I'm concerned. He put together a very, and I hope I'm not offending anyone from Georgetown, he put together a very weak national security team. All of them were gone within a year or two for the most part. When you look at Christopher and Lake, Aspen, Woolsey at CIA was a very peculiar appointment. Clinton did something that I think needs to be corrected one of these days. He ruined the foreign policy bureaucracy, as far as I'm concerned. He bowed to the right wing in abolishing the Arms Control and Disarmament Agency and abolishing the United States Information Service, two institutions that we genuinely need in Washington for the making of foreign policy. And then, of course, he expanded NATO, the enlargement of NATO, which made no sense. The Cold War is ending, and you're taking the military alliance that took credit for the winning of the Cold War, whether that was accurate or not, and you bring in more members to draw it closer to Russia, and even bring in, as George Bush did, former republics of the Soviet Union into this alliance, and you wonder why the Russians are upset about this. And then finally, Clinton lost his nerve on things that this country needed to do in terms of international agreements. We needed to be part of the International Criminal Court. We needed to sign the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty. We needed to be part of the ban on landmines. We needed to be part of the ban on cluster bombs. We should have been part of the banning of the use of teenagers in combat. Over 100 nations have signed all of these pacts. And if you look at the countries that didn't sign, they're what we call the rogue nations and the United States. So then we get to George Bush. It's painful to talk about those 8 years. The fact that this country reelected George Bush does not say very much for any of us anywhere. You've always had misuse of intelligence in war to a certain degree. You certainly had it in the Mexican War. In the 1840s, you had it in the Spanish-American War. But you had not, and Vietnam, certainly. The Gulf of Tonkin Resolution was based on the misuse of intelligence. But you've never had the systematic distortion of intelligence the way you had it in the run-up to the Iraq War. You never had a CIA director like George Tenet tell the president it would be a slam dunk to give you the intelligence, not to help you make up your mind, but to help you convince the American people that we need to undertake this war. It was a total misuse of intelligence, and of course it was false intelligence. And frankly, if you look at Bush, if you take his first 3 years, 2001, when he walked away from the ABM Treaty, I was involved with the SALT talks in Vienna in 71-72. The ABM Treaty was the cornerstone of strategic deterrence. If you didn't have defensive missiles, whether they worked or not, and we can argue that later, but the only way you can make a sound argument for really reducing the number of strategic offensive weapons by not having a defensive system that would be a counter to it, and that's in wiping out the ABM and deploying a national missile defense, and you people in California should be very confident. Only you in Alaska have it. I hate to tell you this, it doesn't work because it doesn't know how to recognize a decoy missile from a real missile, even though we put $10 billion a year into it. It's an extremely expensive weapon system. We've been at it actually since the Eisenhower administration. I don't know how many hundreds of billions of dollars have gone into this thing, but there it is in California and Alaska. And then in 2002, Iran, which had been working with us secretly to quiet the Afghan situation, woke up one morning to find out they were part of the Axis of Evil. Well, they were quite puzzled, reasonably, having fought a war with Iraq for 10 years and had nothing to, really to do with North Korea. Why were they part of the Axis of Evil? So a chance we had really to do something to improve the U.S.-Iranian relationship was really undermined with that speech. And we've been to-ing and fro-ing over this, actually, for the past 10 years. And then 2003, you get the Iraq War, one of the two unwinnable American wars the United States felt it had to engage in over the past decade. Obama, unfortunately, comes in with very little background in foreign policy, never had paid much attention to it, served in Washington for only 2 years, and I was a very enthusiastic supporter of Obama and remain, but I think those of us who had looked at him knew that national security could be a problem. And when he appointed a Secretary of State for domestic reasons, and appointed a Secretary of Defense for domestic reasons, and appointed a retired Marine general to be the National Security Advisor. He lasted about a year. And put Leon Panetta, and I know he's one of your neighbors in California, but he was captured by the operational mentality in the CIA before he had been in the building more than a month. This was an extremely weak national security team. Obama also, I think, was rolled by the military. That's how you got the surge of forces. I think he realizes he was had by the military, and I think that is very important. And one of the reasons why I'm a little more optimistic about this second term is I think this is a wiser man in terms of foreign policy. And if you look at the fact that he has ended the war in Iraq, he is meandering toward ending the war in Afghanistan. He's allowing the Pentagon. And you've got to remember, when you're looking at the Pentagon, you're looking at some, an institution that has the fine motor skills of a dinosaur. It takes the Pentagon a long time to put something together, such as a timetable for withdrawal. All Obama has to do, and I know it's not this simple, but I would look at the Gorbachev experience. He came in 1985. He gave a secret speech in 1986 denouncing Afghanistan to his Politburo colleagues as a bleeding wound. He had Shevardnadze secretly tell Shultz we were getting out, that the military was going to get 1 year to turn it around, and they wouldn't be able to. 88, he announced a timetable. 89, they were gone. We need to do something similar. Military's had its chances. We've had 11 commanders in Afghanistan in 11 years. Take a look at Thomas Rick's book, The Generals, which devotes a lot of attention to this. That's not a war where we can be successful. It's not the kind of military we have. There's no military that's ever been successful in a counterinsurgency where the insurgents have a sanctuary. And not only do they have a sanctuary, but they have an ally in Pakistan who we provide with billions of dollars in military and economic aid that makes the picture somewhat confusing to, you know, how do you disengage from a situation where you're supporting a vertically integrated criminal enterprise that's called the Karzai government. But I think we are finding our way to some resolution of that crisis, but again, I don't know how many years this is going to take. My optimism, just to jump into that for a minute, is the team. Kerry and Hagel, I think, are two good appointments. In fact, I wonder why Obama wasted so much time with Susan Rice, who I don't think was qualified to be the Secretary of State, when he had someone like John Kerry, whose whole career was devoted to becoming an aspirant to the position of Secretary of State. Chuck Hagel is a wonderful nomination, and the criticism of him, frankly, is silly. I mean, anti-Semitism. I mean, people are really throwing that around so loosely. It's embarrassing. to see accusations like that, because once he said Jewish lobby instead of Israeli lobby. If you go back to Aaron Miller's book, he said Israeli lobby on many occasions. But the Israeli lobby is a Jewish lobby, so I don't quite know what the debate is all about. And I think it's going to just sort of slither away because it doesn't make a lot of sense. Hegel is a sound man. He has all the qualifications that you would need. I was very disappointed when Obama made Petraeus the CIA director, but Petraeus took care of that himself and took himself out of the game by giving adultery a very bad name in the process. But why? What was Obama thinking when he took an active duty four-star general who had strong policy positions on some of the key issues that intelligence officers were going to have to grapple with? I can't think of a better scenario for politicization of intelligence than having Petraeus at the CIA. That's not what Harry Truman had in mind when he created the CIA in 1947. He didn't want to put it in the hands of policymakers, and certainly not in the hands of military policymakers. What the CIA was created for was to challenge military intelligence, which is worst-case intelligence. And when the CIA has done its job correctly, that is what they have done on things such as arms control or Vietnam, for that matter. What needs to be done? And let me just check the time here because I want to leave. We don't have a lot of time. Let me go over two areas very quickly. One that deals with the defense budget and the other that deals with the need to demilitarize the entire national security system. There's a chapter in the book that deals with the defense budget. I'm not going to get into the specifics of a reduction. I would just argue that you could take $1 trillion very easily out of the defense budget over the next 10 years. You would still have the same level of spending that you had in 2007. There would not be any risk to American national security. We spend as much for defense as the rest of the world combined. We've doubled the defense budget over the past decade. We're responsible for 75% of the sales of sophisticated military equipment overseas, $75 billion last year. Russia is the second most active merchant of arms, and they sell about $5 billion worth of military equipment. And I even question the whole issue of military aid as it's run by the Pentagon. Just look at the top six recipients of military aid and ask yourself, what are we getting for this? You know, the list would be Israel, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Egypt, Turkey, and Iraq. Israel shouldn't be getting any aid from the United States. They don't need aid from the United States. They no longer get economic aid. They certainly don't need military aid. They don't face an existential threat that would require it, and they have a pretty self-sufficient military industry, highly sophisticated military industry, and they can afford to buy the weapons they buy. Afghanistan, again, we're just feeding this criminal enterprise. Who knows what's going to happen when we reduce our presence there. Pakistan, Iraq, you all know what the problems are in those situations. But if you go and look at the service structure and start with, say, nuclear arms, think of the $5 to $6 trillion we've invested in nuclear arms that are essentially an unusable weapon system. What are you going to do with 70,000 nuclear weapons? I mean, we don't have that anymore, but that's how many nuclear weapons this country has built since the Cold War began. We still spend over $50, $60 billion a year on our nuclear component. In 2009, a secret committee met. It's the JASN committee, which is a group of scientists and military specialists that reports to the Pentagon, that says we no longer need to develop new weapon system. But the price for Obama to get his strategic arms control agreement through the Congress was to bow to Senator John Kyle, who insisted on $80 billion for modernization, new modernization. Very unnecessary. We don't even have a plan or a strategy for all of the nuclear components that are deployed all over this country that create real safety concerns for the people who work in this area. The Air Force and the Navy are tremendously overbuilt. Air Force faces no threat. The Air Force has faced no threat since World War II. If you look at the last two fighter aircraft programs, the F-22 was designed to counter a Soviet fighter aircraft that was never built. Soviet Union was collapsing in the 1980s, something that the CIA missed entirely. The first F-22s were supposed to cost $35 to $40 million a copy. By the time the last one rolled off the assembly lines, I think it was something like $160 million. And now we're repeating that and actually doubling down on the F-35. And again, Lockheed Martin is doing what Lockheed Martin always does. They make sure there is a component of the F-35 built in every state in this country. I think 47 states have something to do with the F-35. Even John McCain said he had sticker shock when he saw what the final cost of the F-35 will be. The Navy, again, 11 aircraft carriers and carrier task force. China has one carrier. And that's from the Ukrainian Navy. I don't know how good Chinese sailors feel about serving on this Ukrainian aircraft carrier, but that's exactly what they have. We have over 200 bases and facilities in Asia. China has nothing outside of China itself. The Marines are interesting to me because the Marines are larger and more powerful than the entire British military. When's the last time the Marines conducted an amphibious landing, which is what they get a lot of their support for? 1951, the Korean War. Yet they have the Osprey helicopter, and they were talking about an expeditionary fighting vehicle. They're getting an F-35. That's another thing about what we do. Every service has its own Air Force. So in addition to the Air Force, you have the Army, the Navy, the Marine Corps that have their own capability in terms of an Air Force. And finally, you have the Army structured at about 547,000. You could save a couple hundred billion dollars over the next 10 years by reducing that to a reasonable 360,000 soldiers. So there are just some of the things that could be done that could get you to the trillion-dollar figure that people say would really disarm the United States. No, it wouldn't. Now, $487 billion has already been agreed to by the Senate and the House over the next 10 years. A sequestration would involve another $492 billion, which would get you close to a trillion, but there won't be a sequestration. So that kind of cutback we won't see, and we don't see anyone in the Pentagon really working toward this, and Leon Panetta has never really asked for it. So this creates a serious problem. Now, demilitarization is a more important issue because what we have done is militarize the entire national security process. I have a chapter here on the militarization of the intelligence community. It deals with all of the military people who've been placed in positions that should be occupied by civilians. Bush put in a four-star Air Force general, Michael Hayden. Michael Hayden, by the way, was responsible at the National Security Agency for the warrantless eavesdropping. This didn't even come up in his confirmation hearings. I've mentioned David Petraeus, who never should have been put in charge of the CIA for very obvious reasons. The State Department has become an extremely weak institution. We have not had effective secretaries of state for 20 years. Schultz and Baker were the last effective secretaries of state. Powell could have been if anyone was willing to listen to Colin Powell, but no one was, and then he really embarrassed himself by going to the United Nations in February 2003 and repeating the phony CIA National Intelligence Estimate from October 2002 that had the 20-some charges against Iraq and their nuclear capabilities and terrorism, all of them wrong, every single one of them. So this institution has to be rebuilt, and I think we have to show more vision in the use of diplomacy. We need a timetable for Afghanistan. We need to respond to diplomatic situations where Obama could look very good in terms of seizing these opportunities. Cuba may not be a major opportunity, but it's certainly low-hanging fruit. Cuba has made it clear they want a different relationship with the United States. We're the only one who pursues this ridiculous policy toward not recognizing Cuba. North Korea did something very interesting in 2009. Remember when the two young journalists stepped across the border and were arrested? And the North Koreans made it clear that if you send Bill Clinton, we will release these two women. Well, why Bill Clinton? Well, Clinton had negotiated the agreed framework with North Korea. And I think this is something North Korea wants to get back to with the United States in terms of bilateral negotiations, because only the United States can guarantee essentially the security of North Korea by assuring them we're not interested in regime change. So I see there's a certain restlessness in the room, and I've probably gone on longer than I can. Let me just close by saying you're not going to change these situations or solve these problems by engaging in the same kind of thinking that got you into the problems in the first place. This is something Albert Einstein said about American foreign policy encountering Joseph McCarthy in the late 1940s. So it's time to, as Lincoln would say, disenthrall ourselves and deal with the real world as it exists out there. And this will require serious dialogue and serious change in the thinking of the people who occupy very important positions in Washington. And that's what the book is about. So. No, I took too much time. I'm glad you did. You should have cut me shorter.
A lot of questions deal with the your thoughts about the defense budget. I think you touch upon it quite a bit in the later part of the talk. And a lot of people may have asked a question before you got to it. Mm-hmm. And the question is, can we really reduce the defense budget? Do you think it's too high? And do you think there will be any chance of doing so through the Congress?
Well, the chance of doing anything in the Congress is fraught with all sorts of peril. And as I said at the outset, the defense budget is the third rail of American politics. It's hard to mention any real savings or real changes in the defense budget without antagonizing not only the Republicans but certain Democrats. The Senate looks at these weapons programs as jobs programs. They don't look at them as, why are we doing this? Why are we building this? Lieberman, who's now not in the Senate, but he's typical in that there are huge defense industries in Connecticut, and he sees submarine construction as part of a jobs program for Connecticut. You have two so-called liberal senators, that's what I read in the mainstream media, Feinstein and Boxer. You know what their positions are on anything involving military weapon systems that are built in California. They don't sound very liberal on any of that. And I'm not talking about abolishing the F-35. I'm asking, why were we originally going to build 3,200 of them? Now I think it's 2,400. But this is a weapon system that was initially budgeted at something like 70 to 80 million per plane. It's now up to 160 million, and they haven't ironed out all of the problems associated with it. So it's going to be very difficult because of the way the five major military-industrial firms have co-opted. You have a congressman in California. I guess he's Southern California, so you probably don't think it relates to you in Northern California. Buck McKeon, who's head of the House Armed Services Committee. He gets more money from Lockheed Martin than any other congressman. 385 of the representatives of the 400 and some in the Congress get money from Lockheed Martin. In McKeon's district, there is a Marine Naval Station. There's an Air Force base. There is an Army base. Lockheed Martin has its big R&D facility. Buck McKeon has never served in the military. He's one of these typical chicken hawks who can't build enough of this military equipment. And some of this goes back, you know, to Madeleine Albright, Secretary of State under Bill Clinton. And we all remember what she said about the indispensable nation, which is very dangerous talk, but put it in the context that she said it. If we have to use force, we are America. We are the indispensable nation. Well, that's dangerous thinking.
The next popular question was, to what extent is 9/11 false flag operation by elements of CIA, and what is your opinion about the 9/11 report? Was it a cover-up?
Well, 9/11 wasn't a false flag operation. That's silly. The 9/11 investigation was not a cover-up, but I wasn't satisfied with the report because it didn't go deeply enough into the intelligence failures. I've written about this in my last book, Failure of Intelligence. 9/11 did not have to happen. There were very serious intelligence failures. There was a wonderful Inspector General's report done on the 9/11 that we'll probably never get to see. And I think part of the so-called intelligence reform, which has been a real setback, was to exploit the problems of what the CIA got wrong in terms of the run-up to 9/11. But when I think of people like Colleen Rowley of the FBI, who was ignored by the FBI, and those who were calling for certain intelligence activities in certain areas, we probably could have prevented 9/11. But I don't call it a cover-up. I call it inadequate in the same way the Earl Warren report on the Kennedy assassination was inadequate because it didn't look at every scenario. It developed a scenario, which the FBI should never do in its training, to develop one scenario and then create all of your assumptions around that without looking at various scenarios.
The other question was this, is that Jose Rodriguez wrote in the Post that the waterboarding never occurred. What is your opinion?
Did he say that? I thought Rodriguez said that he said that they did not torture. He didn't say waterboarding didn't occur. I mean, we know waterboarding occurred. Rodriguez is typical of the CIA's double standard. If you're a former CIA officer who says things that are attractive to the CIA and supportive of the CIA, you can get things cleared. So Rodriguez, who was instrumental in conducting torture and abuse, and again, I don't want to pick on California, but you do have a professor out here at the University of California, Berkeley. Maybe he's moved, but is John Yoo still in California somewhere? He helped to write five memos that fortunately Eric Holder did release that permitted torture at a certain level. But my problem with Obama has always been the torture that the CIA conducted went beyond what the Justice Department said was permissible. This country should not torture. Our number one authority on torture in this country is John McCain, who was tortured over a long period of time and has been a huge critic of this country conducting torture. What's going to happen to American officials, military, intelligence officials, foreign officials, foreign service officials who wind up in the hands of others who know that the United States has been torturing? You know, what did Benghazi have to do with anger about the role of the CIA in the Middle East? That's never been explored. You know, we've always looked at Benghazi as the problem of a consulate. That was a very loosely constructed consulate in Benghazi. I thought it was an intelligence platform. There's a lot of anger about renditions, torture and abuse, secret prisons. And we've really swept all that under the rug in this country. A lot of us thought that Obama would address some of this. And he hasn't. You know, Guantanamo remains open, but as someone has written an op-ed in the New York Times, people who are in Guantanamo are probably better off than if they're brought to the United States to serve in prisons here in this country, given what's happened to Guantanamo because of Human Rights Watch and the Red Cross keeping an eye on things. But there's tremendous anger throughout the Middle East and North Africa. And that's why Americans take a certain amount of risk when they serve overseas. And what just happened in Algeria is just another reminder of the peril. But all of that is within a context of activity that's been taking place for the last 10 years. And again, it's about the overuse, I think, of military violence. We've got a situation now that needs to be addressed with regard to the drones. We need a legal architecture for the use of the drone. We're setting an incredible precedent. Israel has drones. Hezbollah has a drone, at least one drone. They overflew Israel not too long ago. It was a drone that Iran supplied to them. what happens when Russia starts using them against maybe former Soviet republics or China? What kind of world do we want to create out there? Too many things that we do because we can do them without thinking. You know, that's national missile defense. Yeah, we could develop national missile defense. The fact that it doesn't work doesn't seem to be slowing anyone down, but we still pour $10 billion into it every year because we can do it, instead of not having missile defense and get serious about cutting back strategic offensive arms. We still have 2,500 deployed, 2,500 in reserve, and a couple thousand others. Tactical nukes still have not been addressed. You know, there's a lot to do. And maybe if we had an arms control and disarmament agency that Clinton abolished because Jesse Helms made him nervous, maybe we could address those things. You know, what happened to the arms control? There used to be an arms control lobby in this country that was quite effective. I don't see much of their activity anymore.
The other question was, whereas we have done very successful rebuilding the country after World War II in Japan and Germany, how come it's so difficult in nation building in Iraq and Afghanistan?
Because they're not nations. The problem with Afghanistan is we're trying to do what the Soviets tried to do. We're taking a page out of their playbook, which is you come in and you try to build a centralized government. When has Afghanistan ever had a centralized government? It's run in a decentralized way. And what I see happening already with the fact that we've taken out 33,000, you know, the surge forces are no longer there, now they're going back even more aggressively toward decentralization. The warlords are getting active. The ethnic tribes are getting more active. Kabul doesn't count for much to begin with, but will count for much, much less. Iraq had some claims to being a nation state, but it was sitting on this triad of Kurdis, Sunni, Shia that Saddam Hussein sat on with force. Once you remove that force, we had no plan for what we were going to do. A lot of people felt we went in there for the oil. No, I don't think so. Or we were going to stay over a long term. No, I got classified briefings at the National War College from the Pentagon. We went in March, I believe, and we were going to be out for the most part by the end of the year. There was no long-term plan. In fact, if you want to fault the Bush administration for something, and that's why I think Thomas Rip's book is unfair toward the military, we discouraged thinking about what to do with regard to Iraq. So then we had to work by the seat of our pants, and by the time we left, we really not contributed anything, but we had this false confidence that somehow David Petraeus, who we've turned into an icon, conducted a surge, and that made a difference. That's not what made a difference in Iraq. What made a difference in Iraq is the Sunni awakening. And that was started before Petraeus ever got to Iraq. It was General Casey and General Avezzad. And they encouraged the Sunnis to get involved because of what al-Qaeda in Iraq was doing to their country, the incredible violence. And that dealt with the dispute between bin Laden and al-Qaeda in Iraq. But again, we formulate this idea. We did it for the Soviet Union and we did it for China, that these are totalitarian groups and they're black box organizations. And once they make a proclamation, everyone salutes the proclamation. No, that's not true. It's not even true among terrorists and insurgents. These groups have different ways of acting. What happened in Mali was someone who walked away from al-Qaeda. So it makes it very hard to work in that environment because we don't have great intelligence on these organizations. We don't know what we're doing in Afghanistan. We don't know what we're doing in Iraq.
We know how to go in. We don't know how to get out.
You never know how to get out. And we've learned that.
One last question. We are coming to that time. Since you have security clearance all this time, when you make a speech or when you write a book, do you have to have a clearance from any of the authorities?
I wish you... Who asked that question? I want to speak to you afterward. I have never submitted any speech article. This book was submitted... there were suggestions that were called for. I made some. I provided footnotes to explain others. And I challenged the ones that I thought had nothing to do with classified material, and never heard anything again. So.
Well, thank you very much for a most interesting talk.
That's a great way to leave it.